So we're sitting out here on a windy Wellington but sunny day at the embassy. I'm here with Haida Marie Stephanishin Piper, who's a former NASA astronaut and US Navy captain and experienced underwater salvage officer. Welcome, Haida Marie.
Well, thank you. I'm quite happy to be here.
I'm going to kick things off with a couple of questions from my young son. One is, how do you cut your hair in space without it floating around?
Okay, so astronauts have had to cut their hair in space. My two missions, I was on the space shuttle, and first time 12 days in space, second time 16 days in space. So after about 2 weeks, you don't really need to cut your hair. But the crew members that stay on the International Space Station, they're up there for 6 months. And so, yes, they do need to have some hair maintenance being done. And the way they've done it is that they have a sort of hair cutter. So they give each other haircuts, and one crew member will be sitting there and the other crew member will have the hair cutter in one hand and have a vacuum hose in the other hand.
All right, okay.
And so as you're cutting, you're basically sucking up all the hair so it doesn't float around the cabin, because that wouldn't be very good.
Yeah, that's pretty smart. I'll pass that on to my son. And then the last question from him, are there any aliens out there?
Okay, so I get asked quite a bit about aliens, so your son is not unique. As far as we know, no. We haven't found any evidence of aliens, but, you know, we leave that open to say there's a very high probability that there could be aliens out there. The universe is huge. It's vast. And we are just this tiny little speck in the universe. So the chances that we're the only life form is probably a little slim, but we just haven't found any. And they haven't found us. We have no evidence of aliens, but we're still looking. There are offices out there seriously looking, not just, you know, pretending to look.
Yeah, for sure. All right, we'll check those questions off, so he'll be happy with that. Did you ever imagine yourself as a kid that you'd become an astronaut?
No. When I was growing up, there were, you know, women weren't astronauts, and it was just not something that I thought that was what I could do. I grew up in Minnesota, and not in a big space town. And so I didn't think about it. I do remember a couple of interactions of seeing astronauts on television. And I did one time think that, you know, I could probably be an astronaut. It was in the mid 70s when NASA did a test project with the Soviet Union at the time. And we launched an Apollo spacecraft. They launched a Soyuz spacecraft, and the two docked in orbit. And I remember watching a filming of when they opened the hatches and the two commanders talked to each other and greeted each other. And I could hear the cosmonaut speaking Russian. And I grew up speaking Ukrainian. My father's from Ukraine. And I could understand a little bit about what they were saying. And that's the only time I ever thought about, hey, I could become an astronaut. And then if we did something with the Soviet Union, I could talk to the cosmonauts. But then that was only a one-off program, and it kind of went away, and I went off just finishing high school, and it wasn't until later on in life that I realized that, yeah, I could become an astronaut.
That's amazing. Then skipping ahead a little bit to when you were in space, what was that first spacewalk sensation like?
So the very first spacewalk on my first mission, I remember that my spacewalking partner, he opened the hatch. And when he opened the hatch, he said, Heidi, you're lucky. It's a night pass. So which meant you go outside, it's, you know, everything's dark. And I said, okay. I had been night diving before.
Yeah.
And I've been diving in very poor visibility conditions, so the dark didn't bother me. We have lights on our helmets so we can see, you know, a good distance around us, our work area and where we need to be. So it wasn't a problem. So I got outside and, you know, I was probably more nervous to make sure that I didn't make a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
That was my biggest fear, was making a mistake outside. And so you just come out, you practice all of your procedures and your steps numerous times underwater in a pool. That's where we do our training for spacewalks. And when I got outside, I realized our training was very good. It did a very good job of mimicking the space environment. Biggest difference is that in space, you're in a vacuum, so there's nothing around you. So you get outside and you find out that you move very easily.
Okay.
As opposed to being in the pool, you've got water around you and it dampens a lot of your emotions and your small movements. And so it just took a little bit of getting used to it.
Yeah.
And then just headed out and went to work.
So can you tell us that time when there was the tool bag incident?
The tool bag incident, yes. That was on my second mission.
Okay.
And yes, I lost a tool bag in space.
And it's still out there somewhere?
No, it's not out there anymore.
Oh, okay.
It only spent 9 months in orbit. I guess I must have, when I let it go, I must have given it a retrograde motion, that it was more down towards Earth.
Yeah.
And so that started it. And, you know, objects out in space, they do still feel gravity and there is still drag on objects. And so orbits do decay. And so it spent 9 months in orbit and it was gone. But yes, what happened is that tool bag, it was something small about the size of, you know, a very small briefcase. And it held some of the tools that we use at the work site. It's a nice little box. It's got tethers inside so all your tools can be tethered.
Yeah.
And it's got a tether on the outside that you can, you tether the box itself. What had happened is that on the outside of the tool bag, we strapped these grease guns because our job was to go out and apply the grease for lubrication on this big race ring that allows the solar panels outboard to rotate 360 degrees. That outer surface was failing, and part of the reason why it failed was lack of lubrication. And there was a lot of metal shavings because the outer surface was basically being crumbled.
Okay.
So we were using the grease also to clean up that metal, because how do you clean up metal shavings in space?
Yeah.
You can't use a vacuum outside.
I'd love to hear.
And you can't sweep it up because it'll just get all over the place. And
yeah.
So we found that if we used grease, it would, you know, obviously it sticks to it. And then you have these wipes that you can, you know, put in a trash bag and contains all the material. So that was our job. One of the grease guns liked to leak. It leaked a little bit. And I was amazed at how much a small amount, because it wasn't like I saw a huge ball of grease, but it was like little, must have been a little piece of grease that just bounced around the bag enough to get all over the place. And I had it on my gloves. It was in a couple of places. And so I called the ground, told them what happened. I said, I'm just going to clean it up. So the bigger toolbox that we took out all the tools in, had two stringers, you know, two straps with a bunch of hooks in it, all, you know, the new bearings, bags to hold the old bearings, and some other things that we needed. So I just went down one end, make sure everything was clean, went down the other one. The very last thing I picked up was this toolbox that was put inside in between the two stringers, picked it up, wiped it off, didn't even notice that the tether was not attached, and I let it go.
Oh, no.
So it floated off. Luckily, we had duplicate sets. My partner and I figured out a better way of doing it and using just the one set of grease guns that we had.
Yeah.
And so we ended up fixing the space station. Yes, I did lose a tool bag. Mistakes happen in orbit.
Yeah.
And, you know, usually the important thing is, first off, don't make the mistake.
Yeah.
You know, but it's amazing how when you get tunnel visioned on another problem, you know, I had the leaking grease. I had to clean it up. I knew that would put me behind schedule. And I just wanted to get back to work. And this was the very last item. And I just didn't pay attention to notice that it wasn't hooked up. And so it flew off.
Yeah.
Like I said, we didn't get the space station back into a good configuration. And after we left, they were able to put it back in the full operation. So that part made me feel good.
Yeah, for sure.
Not the lost tool bag.
No, most definitely. And while you were up there, what sort of food did you enjoy eating?
So my favorite dish that I had on orbit was seafood jumbo.
Okay, yeah.
So you can definitely tell that we're from Southeast Texas.
Yeah.
With a lot of Cajun food. And so that was one of my favorites.
Yeah.
There were a couple of things that I thought I would like in space that I really didn't care for. One of them is shrimp cocktail that everybody raves about in space. It's dehydrated shrimp with cocktail sauce that you add water to it, squish it around, let it sit for a little bit, and people love it. I had it the first day in orbit, and I was like, nah, I don't like this.
Yeah.
And I had it on my menu a couple more times, and I never ate it. And what we did both my missions, but this was my first flight, is that whenever we didn't eat all of our food, we had the option to say, okay, do you want to save it for yourself? Otherwise, we just put it in a drawer that we called leftover food, because we had to consolidate drawers.
Yeah.
And so just put it in leftover food. And so I'm like, okay, I'm not eating it, so put it in there. And my other crewmates would find it in there and go, Heidi, did you really mean to put this in leftover? Yeah, have it. Have at it. But I didn't keep my seafood gumbo, though.
Yeah, and just to eat it.
Oh, this the shrimp cocktail? I'll eat it when it's fresh, but I don't eat the space.
Let's not go there. What advice would you give to Kiwi and Pacific Island women who are aspiring to become or to get into the space field and STEM fields?
The first thing you're going to need if you want to get into the space field is you have to have a foundation in math and science.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can't stress enough how important math is. And, you know, going through algebra and geometry and taking calculus, because you need that if you're going to get an engineering degree or you get a science degree, a physics degree. It's all based on math. And so that's why the math is so important. I know sometimes it can get frustrating because, you know, people think math is hard. But I always say, look at math as a puzzle.
Yeah.
And there is an answer to it. And you don't want the puzzle to be too easy. And so it just sometimes takes looking at it from a different aspect. And then you figure out that what the answer is and you go, aha, that's it. I should have known. But you get past that. And then once you get into your later years at university, then you start getting to do the fun subjects. And as I say, is that, you know, once you get out in the field, yes, you're not doing these solving, depending upon what you're doing.
Yeah.
Most of the time, you're not solving these complex equations. But you need to have that basis to know when you can do approximations and not need to do every single term. So that's why it's so important. But it is that technical field.
Yeah.
But then I'll also add, having said that, you know, that it is important to have the math. You know, you go to university, you study, whether it's engineering or chemistry or physics or biology. There are also many, many opportunities in the space industry that don't necessarily require going to university.
Yeah.
Just equally important as, you know, scientists and engineers that design hardware, design science experiments, is there is a need for technicians. And so to be whether you're an electrician or a machinist or a welder, those are very highly skills that they do take some training. You do have to go to technical school to learn, you know, whether it's, you know, electricity, electronics, welding, but they're the people that are actually building the hardware.
Yeah.
You know, the engineers will design it. They may be heavily involved in building the prototypes, the first ones, but when it comes to building multiple rockets, that's where you get the technicians come in. And so we need people with lots of different skills.
It's good to know. And then from your perspective, what challenges remain in achieving gender parity in space exploration and in the wider fields of STEM?
So the issue of gender parity is we're getting much, much better.
Yeah.
I look at, you know, people in the space industry today, and I look at especially the younger peoples, the ones that are 20, 30 years younger than I am, and you're starting to see parity. Or even when you get to, you know, one-third women, that is very promising, because when I was going through school, that, you know, we were down to 20%. And so now to see 30, 40%, you know, that's double the number.
Yeah, sure.
It's a lot more. And so, you know, the biggest thing I say to girls is that if you have an aptitude in math and you're interested in it, then by all means, follow that dream. And if somebody tells you not to, then you need to question that as to why they say that you can't do that.
You've also had a career as a U.S. Navy captain. Can you share some impactful lessons from your time serving in the U.S. Navy and your experience in the U.S. Navy?
Yeah, so probably one of the biggest things that learning in the Navy is the importance of following procedures, having procedures, and being qualified.
Yeah.
Is that, because that's what you're always doing in the Navy, and you're always doing training. And so even though you've been trained on something initially, you're constantly doing requaling, because you want those procedures to be almost like muscle memory.
Okay.
And a lot of what we did in the space program was exactly that. But it's based on muscle memory, but you still always refer to the procedures, because if you don't refer, you don't want to rely strictly on memory. So we're not talking about memorizing procedures, but we're talking about being proficient in the procedures so you can go down through things quickly. And the fact that the majority of the training that you will be doing is always based on some sort of failure.
Yeah. Okay.
Because, yeah, you can do training on nominal procedures, but after a while, nominal procedures, you can figure out nominal procedures. But when you start getting failures, that's when you actually get a better understanding of how the system operates. When you learn, okay, you know, I'm learning the electrical bus, and if I lose this bus, what does it do to the rest of the equipment? Yeah. What other equipment have I lost because of the loss of that bus? And what can I do to, can I regain the bus? What does it take? And so you get that in-depth familiarity with equipment, and you get it more so when you start looking at failures than when you don't have failures.
Sure. And is that the same with the salvage operations? Can you share a particularly challenging, memorable salvage operation?
So with the salvage operations, is that the biggest thing you learn there is that, you know, you always have a plan.
Yeah.
But quite often life doesn't go according to the plan, and something is, you're going to have some hiccup in the way. I've had the opportunity to do some pretty unique salvages. I had one that was in Hawaii when I was stationed there, and it was a tanker, it was the Exxon Houston, that broke loose from its mooring point and got pushed onto a reef.
Okay.
And so had to look at how do you get it off the reef without creating more damage, whether it's more damage to the ship or more damage to the reef. And so what made it even more challenging is that, you know, this was not a day of calm seas or nice flat water. It was very choppy on board. So because of what had happened, the ship was not, you know, had minimal power, so they couldn't do a lot. They had also offloaded. They didn't have availability of their pumps to be able to adequately ballast down. And so we just had to figure out with what they had available, how could we, you know, trim out the ship such that when the high tide came, and, you know, high tide in Hawaii is usually, you know, around a meter. So it's not a huge amount of tide, but it was enough to, once we did shift water around, that we could get the ship off the reef, and then Navy tugs were hooked on and they could pull the ship into safe harbor.
Okay. Cool. I'm going to get back to some frivolous questions, if it's okay.
Okay.
I myself, I like pies. It gives me a lot of comfort and a great deal of satisfaction to eat a really good pie.
Okay.
New Zealand's all about pies. In life, what gives you comfort and makes you satisfied?
So a lot of, I guess I would fit in very well with New Zealand because I have gotten to like pies quite a bit.
Oh, that's good.
My husband loves pies.
Yeah.
And so over the years, I've gotten very good at baking pies. But quite often, something that I enjoy doing is baking in general.
Okay.
And I'm probably more of a cookies type person, or as you call them down here, biscuits.
Biscuits, yep. Yeah.
And yeah, there is something comforting about having fresh baked, you know, pastries or biscuits or pies or cake.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. Yeah. And then what's the space equivalent of leaving your keys at home?
So we don't really have keys to the orbiter, so we don't have to worry about leaving those keys at home. But so most of the time, anything that you really need in up in space, is you don't have to worry about leaving your keys at home, because anything you really need, there's multiple checklists to make sure you have what you need.
For sure.
But one example of, you know, if you left your house keys at home is on the shuttle, we would request our own menu. So on the shuttle, we did not have a set menu that said we had to eat these foods, and we could select whatever we wanted, although there were nutritionists that looked at our menus so that to make sure it was a well-balanced diet. Things you had to remember is that obviously if you didn't put it on your menu, you weren't going to have it in space.
Yeah.
And so on my first flight, one of my crewmates who doesn't necessarily drink coffee on the ground decided when he got up into orbit that at the end of the day, he said, you know, I really feel like a cup of coffee. And he liked it with cream and sugar.
Okay.
I was the only one who had coffee with cream and sugar.
All right. So did you have to share?
Well, I did share with them. And so usually he would come up to me and go, Heidi, you have two coffees on your menu. Are you going to drink both of them? And I said, Joe would be more than happy to share with you. You can have one.
And his name was Joe.
His name was Joe. Okay.
That's classic. And how do you fulfill your adventurous spirit post-NASA, post-US Navy?
So now I get the time to go out and travel.
Yeah.
And so I get to go visit those parts of the world that I'm either saw from space. So I said, oh, that's a nice place to go visit. Or places that I never had the opportunity to come visit. Like New Zealand is one of them.
Yeah.
Is that a number of people have talked about New Zealand and have said how wonderful it is. And just during my career, because usually time, because it is does take a long time to get here from the States, it just never fit into the schedule.
Yeah.
And so now that I am retired from NASA, I'm retired from the Navy, and I have lots of time to go travel.
Great. Thanks so much for joining us on this podcast.
I appreciate it very much.
In New Zealand.
I certainly will. Thank you.
Thank you.